sahana vavatu, sahanau bhunaktu, saha vidyan karavavahai, tejasvi navadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti. Narayanam namaskritya, Narayanam naram chaiva narottamam haram. Devim Saraswatim Chaiva Devim Tato Jayamudirayet Tato Pitamahadyam Pravedanti Shashtam Pitamahadyam Pravedan Maharshi Makshaya Vibhuti Yuktam Maharshi Makshaya Vibhuti Narayana Syam Chajameka Putram Narayana Syam Chajameka Dvaipayanam Vedanadhim Namami Dvaipayanam Vedanadhim Namami. Very good. Welcome back. We're continuing on our study of a new chapter of our Moksha Dharma Parva that we study on Saturday mornings. This being chapter 215. And we're just beginning this very fascinating dialogue between Indra and Prahlada. And we're going to see actually two chapters in which Indra is a main character. And what's significant about both these chapters is they both address free will. And there's a lot of confusion about this particular topic. A lot of debates. In fact, when I was younger, I engaged in those debates. You just go on arguing for hours and hours. It used to really be fun. It was for someone like me. For a sannyasi who really likes to study, that kind of argument is just fun. But there's some serious misunderstandings with regard to free will, and misunderstandings which can interfere with your life of spiritual growth. And one of the most severe misunderstandings is when someone concludes, "I have no free will. Nothing is in my hands. Therefore, why should I bother doing anything at all?" That's a tragic and harmful misinterpretation of what is taught in Scripture. So we're going to see these two chapters specifically to address this issue of free will. In our prior class, we saw the opening part of the chapter in which Indra approaches Prahlada for spiritual advice. And bear in mind, let me get this set first. Yeah, this is the 10th verse, which we saw at the end of last class. So Indra sees Prahlada as being someone incredibly content. He's sitting alone, he's comfortable, he is happy, he's unperturbed by everything. In fact, Prahlada is enlightened. And you remember the story, you know, as a boy, he prayed and invoked Lord Vishnu's grace to destroy his evil father. And after his father Hiranyakashipu was destroyed, then Prahlada takes over as king. Now, just to introduce this, Prahlada is very content. In fact, the term used in other scriptures is he's shining with Brahma Varchas. The spiritual effulgence is usually the way that's translated. Indra sees Prahlada shining with spiritual effulgence and definitely wants to know, hey, what is it that makes you so happy and content? In fact, I remember having exactly that feeling when I met my guru, Pujaswami Dayananda. I saw in him a kind of unshakable composure, and a very deeply seated inner peace that was obvious. It was apparent in all of his behavior. And one thing I knew is whatever he had, I wanted it. Whatever he knew, I wanted to know that. Now that apparently is why Indra has come to Prahlada for advice. Now, and in fact at the end of last class, Indra asks, Atmanam, look here in front of me, it's easier. Atmana manyamanaha san shreyaha kim iha manyase. O Prahlada, you atmana manyamanaha, you reflect a lot on your true nature, on the inner self. Shreyaha kim, what is the best thing? Iha, for any person here in this world, manyase, what do you think? What is the best thing to do? Now, to introduce the next sequence of verses, which last week was introduction, today we're into the thick of it. When you see someone happy and content, it could be for several reasons, right? Sometimes people are happy and content because they have, pardon me for being a little sarcastic, there are 18 servants over on the side taking care of every little thing for this person. Whatever they want, all of their desires, all of their comforts, all of their needs are seen to. This person may be the possessor of a vast amount of wealth. Well, it's easy to be happy and content and at peace when you're wealthy, healthy, and everything is going your way. But someone who exhibits this brahmavarchas, a spiritual effulgence, this inner peace and contentment, someone who exhibits it when things are not going well, that's a true sign. It's pretty easy to be happy and content when everything is going your way. But if you can be happy and content in the midst of adversity, tragedy, that's a true sign of enlightenment. And as we're going to see in the next couple of verses, Prahlada is actually not in such a great situation at all. We didn't get to that, so that's where we begin today. What is Prahlada's situation? Indra continues to address Prahlada with verse 11. Let's continue. Baddha pashaischuta sthanad. Baddha pashaischuta sthanad. Dvishatam vashamagataha, dvishatam vashama, shriyavihina prahlada, shriyam vihina prahlada, shochitavyena shochasi, shochitavyena. So Indra is still speaking here, part of his question, and he's addressing Prahlada, and he says to Prahlada, "Oh, Prahlada, Baddha Pashaihi. Prahlada, you are Baddha, you are bound, Pashaihi, with chains. You are bound in chains. Chutaha Sthanat, and you have fallen from your position." We didn't see this in the last class, we stopped just before this. In the last class, we saw that Prahlada was sitting alone. You will remember that. But sitting alone where? He wasn't sitting in his palace. He was sitting in a jail cell. What happened is when Narasimha, Lord Vishnu, as the man-lion, when he destroyed the evil Prahlada's evil father, Hiranyakashipu, then Prahlada became king. That's good. But being king is not always good, because you now have a position that others envy, including Prahlada's cousin, Andhaka. Prahlada's cousin, Andhaka, saw Prahlada enjoying this kingship, and guess, you can imagine what happened. The cousin, Andhaka, overthrows Prahlada, takes over the kingdom, and throws Prahlada in the prison. So, Indra saw in Prahlada this brahmavarchas, this spiritual effulgence, in spite of the fact that Prahlada had his kingdom usurped, he was thrown in jail. Now the description will make more sense. So Indra observes, O Prahlada, you are baddha, you are bound, pashaihi, with chains and ropes. You are chutaha, you have lost, sthanat, you have been deprived of your position as king. Dushatam vasham agataha, you are vasham agata, you have come under the control, Vasham Agata, you have come under the control, Dvashatam, of those who hate you. Not a very happy position to be in. And also, Shriya Vihinaha, you have been deprived of all your wealth. Shriya, you've been deprived of all your wealth. Prahrada is the same as Prahlada, his name. O Prahlada. Shochitavye na shochasi. This is the most interesting observation. Is shochitavye, with regard to things that you should worry about, na shochasi, you're not worried. Prahlada, you're not worried about any of this that's happened to you, which is something that would be of tremendous concern to anyone else. Now we see something remarkable. Prahlada, having been deprived of his kingship, having been deprived of all the comforts that go along with that position, being alone in a jail cell, bound with chains, even then Indra sees this Brahmavarchas, a spiritual light emanating from Prahlada. And Prahlada Nashochasi, he says, you don't worry about anything. All of this should be of great concern, but you don't worry about it. Obviously, Indra sees something remarkable in Prahlada. And Indra's question then concludes. Prajna labhatu daityena, prajna labhatu daitye, utaho dhritimattaya, utaho dhritimat, prahrada swastha rupasi, prahrada swastha rupos, pashyan vyasanamatmanaha, pashyan vyasanamat. So Indra now is wondering why. Why is Prahlada so unconcerned about all that's taken place? He asks, prajna labhat tu daityena? Is it that you are free of worries because of prajna labhat, because you have obtained great wisdom, prajna? Is it because you have obtained great wisdom, uta aho, or is it dhritimattaya, or is it that you have gained great courage? Are you just being very stoic? You know, sometimes people are miserable and they just shut their mouths and don't reveal any of the inner torment going on. That happens a lot. So when you look from the outside, you see someone very calm. Why are they so calm? Is it that they have prajna, great spiritual wisdom, or is it that they are dhritimat? They're just what the American expression, grin and bear it. Bear it means put up with it no matter how bad it is, but with a smile on your face. Of course, it's a false smile. So this is the conclusion of Indra's question. O Prahlada, you are content and at perfect peace in spite of suffering such a great calamity. How is it that you can be so peaceful? Iti sam choritastena, iti sam choritastena. Dhiro nishchita nishchayaha, dhiro nishchita nishchayaha. Oh, I missed something. Sorry. I didn't finish the second line. Sorry. So the second line, concluding Indra's question. Prahlada, O Prahlad, swastha rupaha asi. You are swastha rupaha. You are self-possessed. You are content. You are at home with yourself. Swastha, established in yourself. You are at peace with yourself in spite of this horrible situation. Swastha rupaha asi, O Prahlada, you are at peace with yourself in this terrible situation. In fact, he makes it clear. Pashyan, even though you see, vyasanam atmanaha, this atmanaha, your own vyasanam, calamity, tragedy. Vyasanam atmanaha, your own tragedy, pashyan, seeing, knowing, witnessing, witnessing this terrible state of events, even then, swastha rupaha asi, you are content with yourself, you are at peace. And Indra asks then, how can this be so? Sorry for the missing that in the last line. Now we'll proceed. Iti samchoditastena, iti samchoditas, dhiro nishchita nishchayaha, dhiro uvacha shlakshnaya vacha, uvacha shlakshnaya vacha, swam prajnam anuvarnayan, swam prajnam. Iti, thus, and that's concluding Indra's question, thus, samchoditaha tenaha, tena, samchodita tena, encouraged by him, urged by him. Prahlada, who has been urged to speak, to answer, tena, by him, by Indra. Prahlada, who is described here as dhiraha, as courageous, he is unaffected by this tragedy. And Prahlada is described as nishchita nishchayaha. Why is he so courageous? Is he doing the American grin and bear it? In the previous verse, is he dhritimat? Is he just being the better word is stoic, meaning no matter how much you suffer, don't show anything. So is he being dhritimat, or is he prajnalabha? Has he obtained great wisdom? Well, it's hinted at here. He is dhira, he is courageous. Why? He is nishchita nishchayaha. He has nishchayaha, ascertained, nishchita, what is to be ascertained. He has learned what is to be learned. He has discovered what is to be discovered. And of course, in a Vedantic text like this, what is to be discovered is Atmasurupa, your true nature, being full and complete. So Prahlada is content and at peace in his terrible situation, not because he's being stoic, but because he is genuinely at peace and content. How can that be so? Nishchitaha nishchayaha. Because he has discovered what is to be discovered. He has discovered the fullness and completeness within. And then Prahlada uvacha. He said to Indra. How did he say? You know, the manner in which you speak makes a great deal of difference. You know that very, when you ask someone, how are you? You know, someone's sitting there, say, how are you? And they answer, fine. Kind of tells you something about the person. I'm fine. But here, Uvacha, Prahlada answers how. Shlakshnaya vacha, with sweet words. How's that? So he doesn't bark. He says shlakshnaya vacha, with sweet words. He swam prajnam anuvarnayan. He explains swam prajnam, his own wisdom. He's going to unfold the wisdom because of which he's content. Now think about his situation. He was king. His own family problems are everywhere, right? Look, but they can get pretty severe. Look at this family problem. His cousin overthrew him. He was king. Prahlada was king. His own cousin kicks him out of his own palace and puts him in prison and deprives him of all those comforts. How would you feel if something like that happened to you, if your own cousin did something horrible to you? Now, you may have some little problems with one or two cousins. That's pretty normal. But I don't think any cousin would go this far. This is something else. So let's see what is Prahlada's response to his cousin's evil act. Pravrittim cha nivrittim cha, pravrittim cha nivrittim, bhutanam yona buddhyate, bhutanam yona tasya stambho bhavet balyan, nasti stambho nupashyataha. So here, Prahlada begins to explain why he is at peace in spite of having his kingdom usurped by his own cousin. He says, pravrittam cha nivrittam cha bhutanam yo na buddhyate tasya stambha bhavet. Tasya stambha bhavet. Someone will be... Stambha really means like stupefied, when you're just overcome by emotion. Stambha. Overcome by emotion. Someone would be overcome by emotion in such a situation if nabuddhyate, if they didn't understand, what? Pravrittam cha nivrittam cha bhutanam. If they didn't understand bhutanam for all creatures, for all people, pravritti and nivritti, the things that they do and the things that they don't do, their inclinations and disinclinations, why people do this, why some people don't do that, which is a complicated way of saying not understanding the nature of people, failing to understand the nature of people, human behavior, someone would naturally become stambha, overcome with emotion, paralyzed with emotion, bhavet, they would become. But he says, because of this foolishness, because of balyan, naivete, being so naive that you don't understand or anticipate such behavior. But he says, nasti stambo anupashyataha. But those who anupashyataha, those who understand the pravritti and nivritti, those who understand human nature, I'm paraphrasing, those who understand human nature, nasti stambaha, they won't get upset. What is Prahlada saying here? I'll paraphrase the verse. Those who understand human nature don't get upset. Those who fail to understand and anticipate, I'm adding that word, understand and anticipate human behavior, such people are going to get upset again and again. In fact, stambaha, they will become paralyzed with their emotions, overcome by their emotions. Now, let's try to understand what is Prahlada's insight that allows him to be okay. Prahlada apparently understands pravritti, nivritti, bhutanam. He understands human nature, including the nature of his cousin. He understands that his cousin is greedy. He understands that his cousin was envious, jealous. After all, he was king, not his cousin. He also understands that his cousin was, is a nice American English expression we use nowadays, his cousin was morally challenged. Morally challenged means he couldn't really tell the difference between right and wrong. They couldn't tell the difference between dharma and adharma. You know a few people like that, right? People who cut corners, people who don't really care about what is right and wrong. So morally challenged. Prahlada understood all this of his cousin. His cousin was greedy. His cousin was jealous. His cousin was morally challenged. So Prahlada was not surprised. Nastambaha. He was not surprised when his cousin took over his kingdom and threw him in jail. This is remarkable. he understands human nature so well, he anticipated. If you can imagine him thinking, yep, one day my cousin is going to come here with his army, and he is going to take over my kingdom and throw me in jail. Prahlada must have anticipated it, since he understood human behavior, and therefore Prahlada had no resentment, no hurt, no anger. How is that possible? How is it possible to be the victim of such a terrible act and yet feel no resentment or anger? Here is the spiritual wisdom that Prahlada has, his prajna, his spiritual wisdom. There are two aspects to the spiritual wisdom. One aspect we hinted at before, and that is discovery of the true self being full and complete. That's absolutely essential. Prahlada indeed was enlightened. He had discovered that he's full and complete, therefore he's full and complete in the singhasan, in the throne of the palace, and he is equally full and complete in chains in the prison cell. That inner completeness doesn't change depending on the external situation. But there's something more going on here, more at an emotional level. How is it that Prahlada has apparently no blame for his cousin? He sees his cousin's actions as being inevitable. Given his cousin's nature, he sees these actions as being inevitable. Therefore, no blame. Let's set up some metaphors for this. Suppose your car was parked on the street during a big storm, and a tree branch came down from the tree and smashed the window of your car. You go out there in the morning, and you see your car with a broken window. You look at the tree, and you say, "Tree, why did you do this to me?" No, you don't, right? You're not angry at the tree. You don't blame the tree. You don't seek revenge. You come back with your chainsaw. I'll show you. You're not going to seek revenge on the tree. You're not angry on it. You're angry at it. You don't blame the tree. Why? You understand it's utterly natural and inevitable that in a big storm, a branch can come down from the tree and your car is sitting there. Well, what can you do? So there's one example of if you understand a situation objectively, notice that word, if you understand a situation objectively, there's no blame, there's no hurt, there's no anger. Or to use my guru's language, it's instead of a problem, it's a fact. A broken window is just a fact. If someone threw a rock through your window, that might be different. That might be a problem. But when a tree branch breaks the window, it's just a fact. It's just something you deal with. Okay, there's our first metaphor. We have to work our way up gradually. Now we'll give another example, because you're thinking, come on, Swamiji, it's a tree branch, it's not your cousin. It's a human being doing this. You will say that it's easier to accept it when it's an inanimate object like a tree that causes some harm. But in this case, it's your cousin causing this harm, so we need a better metaphor. Let me give you one of my guru's favorite stories, and a very vivid one. Some of you have heard me tell this one before. It's a situation that shows how, if you understand a situation well enough, you can be free of anger, hurt, and blame, even if that person were to strike you in the face. And this is a very dramatic introduction. Can you imagine someone slapping you in the face, and you wouldn't get hurt, you wouldn't get angry, you wouldn't blame that person? Can you imagine such a situation? Some of you have heard this before. And the answer is yes, if it happens to be an infant you're holding in your arms. taking care of this infant. Infant is a little wild. Many of you are parents. This has probably happened to some of you, at least, where the child is a little wild, swinging his arms around and smacks you in the side of the nose. It hurts. Smacks you hard in the face. Hard enough to make tears go down your cheeks. It can happen. So when this child smacks you in the face, do you get angry? Do you get hurt? Oh, why did you hit me? Do you blame the child? Pravritti nivritti bhutanam buddhyate. When you understand the pravritti and nivritti, the things that they do and the things that they don't do, for all creatures, including the child, you don't get angry or hurt with the child because you know it's natural, it's inevitable. Therefore, what is the point of blame? This is genuine wisdom. Now, good, this will introduce the next verse. Now you're thinking, well, Swamiji, that's okay for an infant, but not my cousin is not an infant. My cousin is a full-grown adult, and my cousin, and you can substitute your own situation, because someone in your family or some friend or some business associate has done something really hurtful to you. Let's make this real. They've done something very hurtful to you. You've suffered because of their hurtful action. What would it take for you to have Prahlada's wisdom so that you weren't hurt by that person's behavior, you weren't angry because of it, you didn't even blame them? If you could come to that perspective, then you wouldn't be upset by those actions. You could remain content and at peace, like Prahlada is, in spite of that hurtful behavior by whoever it is that hurt you. So you're thinking, well, Swamiji, it's not like an inert thing like a tree. It's not even like an infant. I can understand an infant doing something like that, but this was done deliberately. It was done intentionally. He did it. And that's exactly what we're going to address in the next verse. He did it. Who did it? Who is the karta? Who is the agent of action? Is there such a thing as free will? And who is wielding that free will? These are the questions which come starting in the very next verse. And this is where the discussion gets very intense. Svabhavat sampravartante. Svabhavat sampravartante. Nivartante tathaivacha, nivartante. Sarve bhavas tatha bhavaha, sarve bhavas tatha bhavaha. Purusharto na vidyate, purusharto. So Prahlada says, Svabhavat sampravartante, nivartante tathaiva. Says, everyone, sampravartante, whatever they do, nivartante, or whatever they don't do, which means all your that really sums up all behavior, right? Whatever you do and whatever you don't do, sampravartante, what you do, nivartante, what they don't do, all of that is swabhavat, due to their own natures. As natural as a tree to drop a branch, as natural as that child to smack you in the face, it's equally natural for Prahlada's cousin to throw him out of his own palace and put him in prison. That's the swabhava, that's the nature of his cousin. And the person who caused harm to you, I hope it's not your cousin, but it could be, whoever it is that caused harm to you, swabhavat. It was their nature to do so. It was inevitable as if you're holding that child, sooner or later, you're going to get smacked. And when that person is in your life, sooner or later, you're going to be the victim of their bad behavior. It's inevitable. So he continues, sarve bhavaha tata abhavaha. It says, all, let me make the connection here. Make the connection with the prior line. Sarve bhavaha, all those that exist, and sarve abhavaha, all those that no longer exist, all of their behaviors are or were subhavat, due to nature. Whoever is bhava, whoever is living, and whoever is abhava, no longer living, all of their behaviors, sampravartante, nivartante, all of their behaviors subhavat, due to nature, due to their programming, as it were. Now, that leads us to ask the question, what about free will? When we say that behavior is due to swabhava, that seems to suggest that there is no such thing as free will. We'll look at the next few words. Purushartha navidyate. Purushartha is the closest word to free will. Navidyate doesn't exist. What? Prahlada is saying free will does not exist? We have to examine this. First of all, there's no exact word for free will in Sanskrit. The concept free will is probably a Freudian concept, I suppose. It came with modern psychology. The idea that, the idea that human beings are endowed with a will that is free is not exactly the way the ancient rishis looked upon it. The ancient rishis would use two other words. One is purushartha, and the other is kartutva. So they didn't use the word free will. There's no Sanskrit word that means exactly the same as free will. So the two words that are used in this tradition are purushartha and kartutva. Purushartha, purusha artha. Here it means human effort, not will, but effort. Purushartha is human effort. Just simply a person's effort. Whatever you strive to do or not to do, any effort is purushartha. That's one word that's used. The other is kartrutva, the status of being a karta agent. So instead of talking about free will, we're going to talk about effort and agency. These are the words used in Sanskrit. Effort, purushartha, and agency, being the karta. He says here, purushartha na vidyate. There's no effort. Now the implication is, let's apply it to each of the metaphors. Did the tree exert any effort to break your window? No effort, right? Just happens naturally. Did the child make an effort to smack you in the face? It's not an effort, right? It's not like they saw your nose and took careful aim. There it is. Smack. But now, when you think about Prahlada's cousin or that person who caused harm to you, on the surface, it looks very much like the exercised effort, right? It looks like effort. Now we're going to have to go a little bit deeply into this. And deeply into this means when you come across something in a text, like purushartha na vidyate, which seems very surprising and hard to understand, what does he mean? It's time to look at the commentary. This is why we have commentaries. So the commentary on Mahabharata is the one by Nilakanta. And it's quite extensive, so I'm just going to share just a very, very few little bits with you. how the commentator, Nilakanta, explains this. Now, before we continue, bear in mind, and this, I made this comment to introduce the chapter in the last class, please bear in mind that the entire doctrine of karma and reincarnation depends on free will. There's absolutely no question whatsoever. If there's no free will, you can't commit a karma. If you can't commit karmas, how do you accumulate karmas? If you don't accumulate karmas, how did you get born? Further, dharma requires free will. The entire tradition, the entire Hindu tradition, and especially the doctrine of karma and reincarnation, all of this firmly depend on free will. If someone were to say, oh, it's all fiction, it's all a fiction of your imagination, the existence of free will, if someone could prove that, which they can't, then all of his doctrines would just fall apart. So how then? Why does Prahlada say, Purushartha na vidyate, and how are we to understand this? The seed to understanding was something I mentioned when I introduced the text last week. You have to understand a statement based on who's saying it. Context counts for something, right? Who is saying this? So the person speaking this, Purushartha na vidyate, there is no such thing as effort. Who's speaking this is Prahlada, who happens to be enlightened. So we're not getting an ordinary perspective here. We're getting an extraordinary perspective, the perspective of an enlightened person. How should this be understood? So the commentator explains, yatha vaksa utpattehe. This is a typical kind of explanation. You explain it in terms of your life. Yatha vaksa, just like a calf. So the commentator lived in rural India, no doubt. You know, lots of cows and calves. So, and I'll spare you all the Sanskrit, and I'll just paraphrase. It goes on for several lines here. He says that before, it's very interesting, before the calf is born, vatsa utpattehe prak, he says, before the calf is born, the cow's udders are already full of milk. Before the calf is born, the cow's udders are already full of milk. Now, you would think that, you know, when the calf is born, then the mother cow would think, oh, here's my calf, let me give some milk, and then the milk would be produced. No. The commentator observes that even before the calf is born, the mother's udders are already filled with milk, which means nasti pravartaka upeksha. The mother never decided, let me make milk. There was nothing compelling. The mother never chose, never used her will to produce the milk. The milk was produced swabhavika, naturally, swabhavikataha, naturally, without effort. So this is a metaphor that's given, that without decision, without effort, without purushartha, in this case she's not a purusha, the cow, so without any effort, the cow produces milk. So without any effort, the tree drops its branch. Without any decision or effort, the child strikes you. And without any decision or effort, Prahlada's cousin kicked him out? What? Now, the commentator goes a step further. First of all, he's explained, what do we mean by no purushartha? Just like the cow produces milk without decision or effort, in the same way, no purushartha means no decision, no effort. But how could that be true for Prahlada's cousin? Purushartha atmani nasti. This is as clear as it gets. Purushartha atmani nasti. Effort is not there, atmani, in Satchidananda Atma. Now, this is a very profound discussion. Who is it that decides. Now remember, this is being described by an enlightened person. An enlightened person is one who knows the truth of oneself, Satchidananda Atma, and knows that Satchidananda Atma is Shuddha Chaitanya, pure consciousness. Now let's get into this and let's try to get some clarity. Does consciousness make a choice? And let me try to bring this, anything more here? I don't think so. Let's look at this in terms of your experience so that you can really get it in terms of your life and your experience. Do you have free will? In your common experience, you say yes. Do you feel like there's an external force controlling your every movement as though you were a puppet on strings? That's not your experience. You experience yourself as being possessed of the capacity to do something, to do something else, to do things differently. Clearly, in your experience, you have free will. Now, the question becomes, is where does that free will reside? Now, if you're enlightened like Prahlada, you'll understand this, that your true nature is Satchidananda Atma, consciousness. The consciousness by which your thoughts are known. The consciousness by which this experience is known. Right now, whatever is happening right now is known how? Because of you, because of your consciousness. The question becomes, when you choose to do something, you chose to come here this morning for class. You need not have chosen. There are so many things you could have done. You chose to come here for class. When you chose to come here for class, did your consciousness make that decision? Bear in mind, consciousness is that which reveals all the activities of your mind. Activities of your mind, including, tell me, decision-making is a mental activity, is it not? So this morning, you had a decision-making activity. You decided whether or not to come to class. Or for a few of you, it was your spouse who decided to come to class. That's okay. But there's a decision-making process. Then your decision-making process was to go along with what your spouse wanted. Either way, there is a decision-making process that led to your coming. That decision-making process is a mental activity, is it not? That decision-making process was in your mind, illumined by consciousness. So who really made the decision? Where was the decision made? By consciousness or by your mind? Absolutely. Decisions are made with this biological computer. It is. Your brain, your mind, is a biological computer. Of course, that's not your experience. Do you experience like, oh, my mind decided that I'm going to come to class? You don't have that experience at all. Your experience is, I will come to class. Some of you are in the Tuesday night Vedanta class, and you can answer this question very well. Which I is it that said, I am going to class? That's ahankara, that's ego. Another mental event. Decision-making is in your mind. That ego, I, ahankara, is in your mind. And you put the two together, and what happens? I'm going to class this morning. That whole decision-making process takes place in your mind, in your biological computer. What did Atma do? Nothing. Maximum, Atma reveals this decision-making process that takes place in the mind. Now, understanding what we've just discussed, we can return to Prahlada's observation, purushartha na vidyate. With regard to Atma, there is no purushartha. There is no free will. Atma, Satchidananda Atma, the consciousness behind your mind, has no free will. Clear? Does it mean free will doesn't exist? Wait a minute. There's still a mind and an ego in that mind that wields free will. There is free will in the mind. There is no free will for Atma. That's why the commentator says, Purushartha na Atmani nasti. There is absolutely no free will for the mind. I'm sorry, for Atma. Suppose someone looks at this passage out of context. That happens a lot. People will pick up a scripture, pick up a text, even Bhagavad Gita. You pull a statement out and say, hey, it says, Purushartha na vidyate. There's no free will. And then a person concludes, this is what Hinduism teaches. There's no free will. Wait a minute. There's a lot more to be understood. You just can't take a few words out of context like that. You have to understand it. And understand it not only in terms of the flow of verses, but understand it in terms of who is speaking those words. All right, enough said. So we'll see more of Prahlada's wisdom, how Prahlada interprets the situation. Purushartasya cha bhave, purushartasya cha nasti kaschit svakarakaha, nasti kaschit svakarakaha, swayam na kurvatastasya, swayam na kurvatastas jatu mano bhavediha, jatu mano bhavediha. Purushartasya cha abhave. Abhave, in the absence, purushartasya, of effort, in the absence of human effort, nasti kaschit svakarakaha. Nasti kaschit, there is absolutely no existence of svakaraka. So here are the words that are used. Purushartha, effort, and karaka, karta, agent of action, agent. If there's no, to paraphrase the first line, if there's no effort, there's no agent, karta. Svakaraka is the word that's used here. Svakaraka means agent of action. No agent of action? Now, with regard to the tree, there's no karta, no agent of action. Even with regard to the child, you know, it's questionable. You know, the child really didn't think, oh, I'm going to hit her now. So there was no real agent of action behind the child striking you. But for Prahlada's cousin or for the person who caused injury to you, was there an agent of action? Well, depends on your perspective. When you decided to come here for class this morning, was there an agent of action? There was. Someone said, I am going to class. That I is the karta. That I, svakaraka. That I is the agent of action. But who said, I am going to class? Did your consciousness say that? Those words were uttered by whom? Not by your consciousness. Those words were revealed, those thoughts, I should say. That thought, I am going to class, that thought was revealed by consciousness. That thought, however, arose in your mind. So then, where is the karta? Where is the agent of action? The agent of action is the ahankara in your mind. Now, some of you aren't able to join us on Tuesday night for the Vedanta class where we've discussed this very carefully. Let me make it very clear what we're talking about when I say ego or ahankara is the agent of action. In your mind is something that we could call self-concept. It's your own idea about who you are. That idea of who you are includes your name, your age, your whole history, all the things that have happened to you from childhood on, all of these factors together combine to form your self-concept, your self-image. When you say I, who are you referring to? When you use a pronoun I, as a, remember, pronouns aren't, pronouns always refer to something else, right? In English, we use the word pronoun, pro, for, in Latin, right? That which stands for a noun is pronoun. Excuse me. In Sanskrit, we use the term sarvanama. Excuse me. In Sanskrit, pronoun is called sarvanama. It's a name for anything. It's a name that can be applied to anything. I, as a pronoun, is a name that gets applied to different things. To what will you apply the word I? If there's some object, like glasses, will I apply the word I to these glasses? No. On the other hand, with regard to my body, I might apply the word I. With regard to my mind, I might apply the word I. With regard to the person who's lived so many years and the whole history of events that person has undergone, I would apply the word I for that person. In general language, would you apply the word I to pure consciousness? Generally not. What you wouldn't, if your concept of I was Shuddha Chaitanya, pure consciousness, if that was your perspective, could you say, I walked through those doors an hour ago? Consciousness can't walk through doors. Consciousness has no legs, for example. So the point I'm making is that when we use the word I, it's a pronoun, but that pronoun almost always does not refer to your true nature, consciousness. It almost always does apply to your self-concept, to your idea about who and what you are. That self-concept, that idea of who you are, is what we call ahankara ego. Ahankara ego, not in the sense of pride, but as a technical term, describing this mental event in your mind which defines who you are. That mental event, that ahankara, is the karta, is the agent of action. And that's why Prahlada says, purushartasya cha abhave, in the absence of effort, also nasti kaschit svakarakaha, there's also the absence of an agent. In the absence of effort, there's also the absence of an agent. As I said before, you won't find the word free will here, but Prahlada is talking about the absence of purushartha, effort, and the absence of a karta, agent of action. Swayam tu swayam na kurvataha. And when one is swayam, oneself, na kurvataha, not doing any action. Wait a minute. How can you not do any action? We joked about that a moment ago. Did Satchidananda Atma walk through the doors an hour ago? Satchidananda is the truth of who you are. Really speaking, swayam na kurvataha. The truth of who you are is not engaged in any action whatsoever. Swayam na kurvataha. Tasya jatu manaha bhavediha. Then how can there be bhavediha? How could there be, if you don't do any action, then jatu manaha bhaved, then how could there be any pride? I did it. That's mana. That's that pride. I did it. If you're not doing it, if Satchidananda Atma doesn't do anything at all, how can you say, I did it? You can't say, I did it. There's no agency. There's no effort. Now, before we proceed, from this do we conclude that free will does not exist? What a horrible misunderstanding. What Prahlada is very clearly teaching here is that Atma, your true self, has no purushartha, effort, or kartatva, agency, but rather effort and agency belong to the mind. Now, here's something very important. Your mind is natural or not? Part of nature? Let's set the text aside and just explore this a little bit right now, because this is very important. Are you in control of your own mind? Who decides? Who formed your mind, your personality, your values, all that we understand as all of our personality traits? Did you choose your personality traits? Did you choose to be like you are? How is it that we are who we are? Where do our personalities come from? Where do our values come from? If we're honest, we have to admit that all of this was formed in childhood. Most of it, almost all of it, was formed in childhood. As we were growing up, our parents and other authority figures in our lives had tremendous influence on us, such influence that they ended up molding our minds, molding our personalities. Are you the author of your own personality? Now, as adults, we make some effort to change. We find certain things in ourselves that we don't like. It happens. We find certain things in ourselves that we don't like, and we try very hard to change those things. How successful are we in changing those things in us that we don't like? Somewhat, but not terribly successful. Would you agree? We have some ability to change things in our behavior that we don't like. But if you're honest, let me share with you my own perspective as a sadhu, my whole life is spiritual growth, so I work a lot at changing things inside of me through meditation and prayer, etc. In my experience, I would say 98% of what goes on in here is not chosen by me. It's a result of everything that's come to me from childhood onwards. What I can deliberately change inside is maybe a few percent. Most of it comes from childhood. So, are you the author of yourself, of your own personality? If you admit that for the most part you are not the author of your own personality, bear in mind that any decision we make is based on all that programming that we've had from childhood onwards. Every decision you make is 98% dependent on all the programming you've had from childhood onwards. Where is the room for free will? There are two ways of understanding where free will comes in. First of all, 98%. So there's still that 2%. So we are not programmed robots. We are not like animals either, who are just function by instinct. But the point we're making here is the vast majority of our behavior, including the vast majority of our decisions, are in some sense based on our lifelong experience, which is one way of saying based on our programming. It's natural. If you could program a computer to understand every iota of your personality, that computer could predict what you're about to do 98% of the time. That's what we've just described. So where is free will? I said there's free will in two parts. One is 98% pre-programmed. There's still some degree in which we do mold and shape ourselves deliberately, consciously. We do mold and shape ourselves, so therefore there's some free will there. But there's one, and this is one thing I heard from my guru, which was just struck me as being extraordinarily powerful when we were talking about this topic. And it's a challenging topic, you'll agree. Where is free will then? If we're saying we're all 98% pre-programmed, where is free will? And Pooja Swami Dayananda says, free will exists in that you can choose to go contrary to your programming. You can, can't you? We all can. We are highly programmed, and in spite of that, we can choose to go opposite our programming. For example, I was raised in a Christian family in this country. I grew up as a little boy eating McDonald's hamburgers. This is standard fare. That was my programming. I was programmed to eat McDonald's hamburgers. I was. That was my childhood programming. I could easily go against that programming. There is free will. Yes, we are highly programmed. But free will is something so powerful that we can actually go contrary to our own programming. And perhaps the most extreme example of this is we are all programmed to survive, to live. That's the most fundamental programming possible. That is, you know, even a one-cell animal, an amoeba, is programmed to survive. This is in our genes. It's in every cell of our bodies to survive. Evidence that we can go contrary to our programming is that someone can commit suicide. I know it's kind of a gruesome example, but it shows the power of free will. Every cell in your body is programmed to survive. And yet someone who is suffering so terribly, and generally suicide is driven by incredible, unbearable suffering. So someone driven by unbearable suffering uses free will to end their life. So the fact that we are tremendously conditioned and programmed is a fact. Nature. Nature in the form of our mind, nature in the form of our conditioning, nature in the form of everything we've learned from our parents and other authority figures. All of that is natural, swabhava, he said in the text. But in spite of all that, we still are endowed with free will, such a free will that we can even go contrary to that conditioning. It's a complex topic. So what we've seen today is from the standpoint of Atma, Satchidananda Atma, there is no free will. But from the standpoint of this human being, there is a tremendous amount of programming, and yet free will is so powerful, it can go contrary to all of that programming. All right. There's much more to be seen in our text. We'll see in our next class. A couple of important schedule announcements. Tomorrow, Sunday, we have our children's program at 11.